We should be there. It's about time. This is, I think, the third of our city series, a webinar, where we are trying to learn about cities. But let me first begin by giving the general direction that I always give. Please mute your mics. Let the speakers speak first. Then obviously we give everybody a chance to ask questions. You can ask questions later. So don't worry, everybody will have a chance. Meanwhile, don't forget these cartoons that we still have a policy outsourced, and IMF runs the country because we are incapable of running the country. So let's please bear that in mind. Okay, as I keep pointing out, the purpose of our seminars is to debate, create an academic debate for the academic community. We want to introduce our students, our researchers, to new topics for research. We want to speak, get thought leaders like Ben Tederen to speak directly to the universities and to our urban planners and to our various intellectuals. So this seminar is academic. It's not meant to be the usual political thing that you see in Pakistan. Well, today we've got an excellent speaker for you, Brent Tederen. He is a city planner. He was a chief city planner for Vancouver, which is one of the loveliest cities in the world, one of the most celebrated cities in the world. And as you can see from his bio, he planned the 2010 Olympics, which is a huge undertaking, as you all know. He planned many other new housing and, urban regeneration projects in Toronto, in Vancouver. We'll get to those now. Brent has also got his own consulting firm for cities and consulting around the world. I've seen him in Australia, for example. I've seen him in other places. So he does a lot of work in all kinds of places. And we'd like to learn from him today on city development, city planning. And I think this is an area that, you know, I've been talking about a lot. We in Pakistan need to learn a lot about cities. So we'll talk about cities with Brent. Okay, now to give Brent an idea, let me just give Brent what our cities are like. Obviously, he's not been to Pakistan. A mistake that Brent will try and correct very soon, as soon as COVID is over, we'll try and get you to Pakistan. Pakistan is some of the largest cities in the world, Brent. We've got 15 plus million in Karachi, we've got 12 plus million in Lahore, and we've got 20 cities above a million, we've got 100 plus cities above 100,000. So we've got very large cities. But as you can see on the map to the right, we believe in American sprawl. This is the map for Faisalabad. It has been spreading like mad for the last 20, 30 years. We also don't have any local government. We are also getting urbanized at a very rapid rate. As Murtaza was saying, our population is growing rapidly. Plus, we are also urbanizing at a very rapid rate, and you could expect that from a developing country. Our city planning was inspired by Harvard and by the donors, and there's a lot of city planning now that takes place in Pakistan. I would say, in fact, we overplan and we strangulate our cities. That's my view. And a lot of city planning is done by foreign consultants. We are following the American, not the Canadian, but the US suburban model with cars. And you can see the photograph. This is how our traffic in a major area in Lahore, Hall Road, that people know. You can see what traffic is like out there. And this is also a major shopping center. So you can imagine how shopping is also taking place. We also have very rigid zoning. Right? They like to zone us so rigidly that we have to travel miles to go from office to home. And we have a huge premium suburbs. Our planning model is building single family homes, except for Karachi, where there are more flats. But in the rest of the country, there are very few flats. And we are spreading outwards. Our cities are also car dependent sprawl. And Brent, I know you're not very fond of cars, but we are very fond of cars. We are building flyovers, we are building underpasses, we are building signal free corridors, we are widening highways in the middle of the city. That's a very important thing. We love that. We don't like walking at all. Walkability is not allowed. There are no sidewalks, there's no infrastructure for walking. In fact, to cross the street, this is the photograph. You have to climb up 3 stories to cross the street. They don't allow you to cross the street. There's no zebra crossings. You have to walk up because the cars have precedence. We also build expensive metro buses. There are no buses in the street, but we build platforms to make room for the car to build buses. Another thing which is very interesting, I'd like you to comment on that. We have free street parking everywhere, or nominal fee. We have no real street parking policy. It's a very nominal fee that we have. We also like to exclude the poor. This is what happens to poor housing. There's no zoning for the poor. Poor live in older parts of the city in sort of room 5-6 to the room. They have no place for business. If their street vending is disallowed, we call them encroachments. We have no sidewalk commerce, no sidewalks even. So in a sense, what we say, we've done a webinar on this too, that the poor are excluded from our cities. They have no place to live, except they can build informal housing, shanty towns, and then they're thrown out. The Prime Minister now wants to build 5 million houses because it's such a housing shortage. He says he wants 5 million houses. He's willing to give land outside the cities. He's willing to build single family homes outside the city. He's willing to give them subsidies for those homes, but no jobs, no transport. I don't know, is this the way to include the poor? And we'll come to that. So we've got huge shortages, Brent. There's no school space, there's no commercial space, there's no office space, warehouse, all these spaces are not there. What happens is a single family home is converted to these spaces. And our cities have become unbreathable because now they're very, very polluted. They're probably the most polluted cities, some of them are most polluted. So Lahore, my city, is very polluted. And commuting is becoming more and more difficult every day. So our appeal to you, Brent, is to help us think our way through. We are drowning in sprawl, cars, homelessness of the poor. And we seem to have no vision for our cities except to increase the sprawl. And we are very fond of what we call master planning. We master plan our cities every 5-6 years. And then the master plans get written in stone and we get into legal cases on them. And master plans are built by master planners who don't want to talk to the people. So please help us think this through, Brent. So I'm going to now leave it here. And I'm going to just simply say, Brent, can we now start a conversation with you commenting on this? I know you haven't seen Pakistan. And I don't want you to come in and talk, but just tell me, what do you think of this picture that I gave you? How does it sit with your vision of city planning?
Thank you for that. Can everyone hear me?
Yep, we can. Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so, oh, how to start. Thank you very much for that that summary. It certainly gives what I had planned to say some perspective. I think I was just writing things down and changing my mind about what I probably would have said in my introductory comments based on that. But I do want to start by saying one thing. You know, whenever I see a slide that says, help us, Brent, I get nervous. I get nervous for me and I get nervous for you. The last thing you want is someone who's never even been to your cities to try to tell you what the answer should be. And if anything, I can hopefully help in support an ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. But I'm always very careful. I do advise cities all over the world, but I put a lot of pressure on myself to be to learn about those places. And make sure that I'm giving advice that isn't dangerous. And I at least say that if I haven't visited your city, I don't even know what I don't know yet. I don't know how I could be dangerous in giving the wrong advice or bad perspectives. So everything I'm going to say today is in the context of global cities, other cities that I've worked in, observations that I've had that maybe as close to universal as any observations can be. But what I want everyone watching this webinar to promise that nobody's going to say, well, Brent said that Pakistani cities should do this or do that. Because let's be clear, I'm not saying that. Because I don't know. I don't know yet. But I hopefully can contribute to the conversation. Having said that, I started, of course, my career in North America, Canada, and the United States. I started, after leaving the role of chief planner here in Vancouver, I started doing a lot of work for the last 10 years in parts of the world that that I didn't necessarily think I would be able to work in. And when I did start it, I started with a great deal of humility and even some nervousness, because I thought, well, what can a North American urbanist teach other parts of the world, including many parts of the world that are doing things very well? And of course, what I've realized over the last 10 years, and I realized it quite quickly, is that there are universal conversations that are happening in cities literally all over the world. Every city in the world is struggling with cars. Every city in the world is struggling with, most cities in the world are struggling with air pollution. Many are cities struggling with population growth. Many are struggling with the kind of poverty and homelessness or the informal settlements that your cities are struggling with. That doesn't mean the solutions are necessarily the same, but we can start to have a common conversation. I found that when I was working in Latin America, when I was working in Australia and Australasia, when I was working in Europe, I was finding that the base of the conversations were very similar. And so that gave me some comfort that we could at least have a common frame of reference. And what I realized is that every city may be different, but cities are a lot more the same than not. In other words, we have more in common as cities, as people, than we have differences. So that means we can at least have a common conversation. You said a minute ago that you thought, Brent, you're not fond of cars. I actually want to start there. I'm a North American male. I like cars. I think my two little boys are in our living room playing with cars. We're trained from birth to like cars. It's not that I'm not fond of cars. I know exactly the car I would love to buy if I had any reason or any interest in buying a car. As objects, cars are very attractive to us in North America. What I hate is car dependency. What I hate is cars that have been designed in a way that the only rational way you can get around is by car, a very expensive and very high consequence way of getting around. I hate cities where there aren't other delightful choices in how to get around because of the poor land use decision-making and the poor transportation infrastructure decision-making. The car is the only option. Then we are slaves to the cars. Then we are captive to the cars. We've surrendered our city and our city life to the car. That's what I am not fond of. So I think I say that because we have to get away from this debate about whether the object is a bad thing. I don't care if a car is a good or a bad thing. What I care is if we design our cities around them so they are the only rational option. Because if we have too many cars in our cities and not enough other choices, there are significant consequences for our cities, and our cities fail. Our cities fail. And that's what's going to be one of the basis. And that's true of every city in the world. That's true in Latin America and North America and in Europe, every city I've ever been. If we overplan for the car, if we overplan to create car dependency, our cities fail. And they fail in many ways that we're seeing in cities all over the world. They fail in terms of air pollution and the consequences to our public health and quality of life of that. They certainly fail in the context of us being responsible relative to the climate emergency. They fail in terms of affordability because car dependency is expensive and it's disproportionately bad for those who live in poverty or lower income circumstances. They fail in terms of infrastructure costs for our local governments or our higher level governments, the governments that are building the infrastructure. They are incredibly expensive. They fail in terms of racism. They fail in terms of inequity. They fail in terms of all of the consequences of the social consequences of cities that disproportionately hit those in poverty, those who are racialized, et cetera, people of color in various contexts around the world. So in almost every way, except making a certain percentage of the economy money, cars fail. Cars fail cities if we overdesign for them. So I stay away from the debate about whether you like a car better than a bike or a bus or walking. It's about what makes cities work better. And you really educated me even at the beginning of this conversation about your propensity for North American sprawl. Maybe this is a reason why North Americans do have something to say to you folks, because you've copied our worst idea ever. You've taken the thing that we did the worst for the future of our own society, just pragmatically. I'm not talking about ideologically. I'm talking mathematically. I'm talking about all the quantifiable consequences of bad city planning and bad urbanism and bad social infrastructure, public infrastructure, cost, equity, everything, and you're copying it with some enthusiasm. Sadly, the same as many parts of the world are copying it. The costs and consequences of suburban sprawl, which is of course linked to car dependency, that's the problem with sprawl. The problem with sprawl is car dependency. Separation of uses, racism and social fragmentation and isolation, all manifesting in a kind of a suburban pattern that makes you car dependent, that makes you socially dependent, unmixed, tolerant of other people's perspectives and race and everything, or embracing of different cultures. There's all sorts of consequences to sprawl. And this is true universally. Every city in the world that has a sprawl problem is facing many of these similar consequences, because although our cities may be different, pollution works the same in all cities. Geometry works the same in all cities. And if you design around the car and you design low density single family houses, because that's what your culture believes equals success, then the costs and consequences of that are staggering for everyone. It's not a matter as simple as saying this is our choice, because the choice that is being made in the context of the suburbs has costs and consequences for everyone. Vancouver, maybe to switch gears to Vancouver for a second, one of the reasons that Vancouver gets a lot of attention in the North American context is because, at least as a center city, and you have to understand that Vancouver is a center city of a much larger region. As a center city, we've rejected the notion of car dependency, car priority. For over 20 years, our policies have called for a reversal of the prioritization on our streets and roads, walking first, then biking, then public transit, then goods movement, and then the car. We rarely ban the car, but we prioritize it last. And we prioritize people in more healthy and active ways of getting around first. We said no to freeways in the 1970s, so we have no freeways, expressways within our city limits. They literally stop at the border of our municipality. And because we aren't bringing thousands of cars into the city center every day, which need parking and spew pollution, we built a city, a high density city in our center city, where people live close to where they work and they can walk to work. They live in high concentration around public transit, so they can take public transit to work. We built a mixed use, high density, multimodal city where it's easier in many cases to get around. Even as I say, I like cars as an object, but I live in a place in downtown Vancouver where it's kind of crazy to own a car, because it's a hassle here, where you have to park it somewhere, you have to fit it somewhere, it's expensive, it takes up too much space, and it's so much easier to walk and bike and take public transit in our city. So we have to stop focusing on the car versus other objects and think about the urban patterns that we are creating that create either car dependency or a delightful array of choices in how to get around. To get our groceries, to go to school, to go to the hospital in the context of a COVID pandemic, all local within our city, within our neighborhoods. This is the kind of hyper-local conversation that many cities in the world are now having. Paris, the mayor of Paris has launched the quarter-hour city. Melbourne has had the 20-minute city for a long time. In Vancouver, we actually call it the 5-minute city. But the point of it is that if you do your land use correct, if you mix your land uses with higher densities, higher heights, but only to facilitate higher densities, and you design it in a way that facilitates walking, biking, and transit, and not car dependency, then you get a different urban experience, a healthier one, a more sustainable one, also a more socially equitable one, as long as you can tackle the overlapping issue of affordability, which is a constant struggle here in our city and many other cities around the world. So Vancouver is different from the rest of North America because of we didn't reject the car, we put the car in its place. We properly prioritized the car. Cars can get just about anywhere in our city, but they aren't given the priority. And walking, biking, and public transit is given a much higher priority. We said no to freeways, we did our land use and our density differently. And we've ended up becoming one of the most livable high density cities in the world, if not the most livable, depending on who you believe and what ranking you believe. But the point is, we've shown that you can do high density in a way, and mixed use in a way, and multimodal in a way that improves your quality of life, improves your sustainability. Vancouver is not the only city model around the world. I work in many cities that are doing many of the things that Vancouver does better than Vancouver does. And I'm constantly inspired by the cities that I've been working in. We can all learn from Latin American cities that are actually, frankly, better at doing this much faster. I spent 2.5 years advising Medellin, Colombia, which in the 1990s was the murder capital of the world. And their transformation around walking, biking, and transit, particularly public transit, their transformation around taking back their public spaces and becoming one of the most innovative cities in the world after being the murder capital of the world is a constant inspiration to me, my time working with them. What it shows is all cities can be inspired by and learn from other cities, but we've been doing that in the wrong way. Ironically, it sounds like, I said I'm not going to make any conclusions on Pakistan, and I won't, but from your presentation, it sounds like you've been inspired by the biggest mistake North America ever made with its cities. Low-density, car-dependent suburbs, instead of being inspired by the cities that have rejected that and have actually improved their success because of that very strategic
projection. That's why I wanted to talk to you.
Yes.
Let me ask you, related to this is something that you said somewhere, I read it or I heard it somewhere, you said something which stuck in my mind, which is very important. You said that we should do away with freeways and we should have sticky streets. What is a sticky street? I think that's a concept that we should really think about. We used to have them, we don't have them. Can you please tell us what your concept is?
Well, when you let streets, and it goes all the way from expressways or freeways all the way down to a local street, when they get designed by traffic engineers, usually it's based on mathematical exercises about how to move as many people as possible. And let's be honest, it's actually about moving as many cars as possible. So the sidewalks get, the portion that is given to the car gets widened, the sidewalks get tightened, there's certainly no room for buses or bikes. And because it becomes a bit of a, what I call a traffic sewer, which is cars moving as fast as possible, usually a one-way street, which is a mistake for anything except treating it like a traffic sewer. I call those streets traffic sewers because you'd think the only purpose of them is just to move cars through the street like a water through pipe. Because of that, the street wall, the things that are happening at eye level at the street all become sort of blank and dead because nobody's walking along them much anyway. And it just takes away all the friction. And the whole point is to just move everything fast. And I'm convinced it's because engineers are originally trained to do more easy tasks like moving water through a pipe rather than hard tasks like creating a great street. On the other hand, a sticky street, and I didn't invent that term. I heard it when I was young, and I have no idea who invented it, but nobody was really using it, so I'm credited for bringing it back, I guess. I really liked it because the concept is not sticky in the sense of gum on the street or things like that. It's everything in the street creates friction. It seeks to slow you down and to actually enjoy and interact with the street. The things at eye level are visually interesting. There's a bit of street theater. The windows are transparent. The public and private uses are spilling out onto the street and sidewalk to where you actually maybe have to walk around them a bit. But everything is designed to take your attention and entice you to stay. It's sticky because it makes us want to stay and not leave as much. And one of my friends and great mentors, Jan Gehl from Copenhagen, always points out to me and others that you can double the number of people on a street by doubling how many people come, but then you have to figure out where they're coming from, how they get there. You can also double the number of people by doubling how long they stay. And it's actually easier to do the latter. So making your street sticky makes your place more vibrant and successful and vital for longer. And it's the opposite of a traffic sewer. It's a completely different mindset mentality on about what a street is for. And that's super, super important.
Now, another concept that you raised, which I also found very fascinating, was density done right. Now, we all believe in density. And in Pakistan, we have density. It's not that we don't have density, except we have people crowding into tenements, five families to a room, which I guess is density done wrong. So how would you do density right?
Well, let's be really clear. There's a very strong cultural lens to the conversation about density. And I don't understand your cultural circumstances with regard to density, your family structure, your community structure, et cetera. So I'm density done right is going to have a different answer in different parts of the world. So everything I'm saying is not about Pakistan here. But from a we have to differentiate density from crowding. One of the certainly the things that have been discussed during Corona, the coronavirus. And ironically, by the way, everything I just said about sticky streets, it's fascinating how physical distancing as a requirement of the coronavirus has completely changed the definition of what a successful street is. Because everything I just said about stickiness and doubling the number of people by having them stay longer, it's very different when you're in the middle of a pandemic. And you have to realize that, which is why we're actually trying to create more space for people to move safely while physically distancing. In the context of density in urban settings, if you're concentrating many people within households during a pandemic, that can be a bigger challenge than urban density. So that's why the conversation in many contexts is about crowding as opposed to density. But in many cities of the world, when I'm talking about density done well, it starts with the observation that we tend to have a conversation about whether you do density, yes or no, instead of having a conversation about how to do density well. And the problem with that is, I find when I'm brought in by cities to have a conversation about whether they should do density or not, it invariably, my first thing I notice is that the local density is not particularly good. And I don't mean culturally, I mean just from a bad design perspective. And it's very hard to have a conversation about doing more density when the density you've been doing is bad. Because everybody looks at it and says, well, we don't want more of that. I actually call it, I have a nickname for it. I call it the Montparnasse effect for the Montparnasse Tower in Paris that looms over an overlooked Montparnasse cemetery. It was a big, black, horrible object that did great visual damage and shatter damage to the Montparnasse Tower or Montparnasse Cemetery, which is a beautiful historic site. And everybody said, if that's what you mean by density, we don't want any of that. That's awful. We hate that. As a matter of fact, it's the reason why Paris said no to tall buildings for decades until La Défense was finally planned as a place to put it so they could keep it out. But a lot of that came from the conversation of how badly it was done, how obnoxiously bad it was done. So it's very hard to have a conversation about whether to do density, yes or no, when you've got a track record for doing it poorly. So when cities ask me to come in and facilitate a conversation about doing density well, it's about design. First of all, it's about where and where not. Some places you just don't put a tower. It's about where and where not. It's about how. Not everything has to be tall, but tall can be part of the conversation of density. It can be tall, it can be mid-rise, it can be ground-oriented densification, it can be all of the above in different places where it contextually works. But it's about better design. It's about not the design of individual objects, but rather how taller buildings contribute to a strong street, a strong neighborhood block, a strong neighborhood, and create a sense of urbanism. In Vancouver, our buildings are tall, but our buildings all land on a mid-rise podium with active uses on the street that create strong blocks, strong streets, strong neighborhoods. And instead of riding down the elevator and getting into your car, you ride down the elevator and walk out and walk to the grocery store or to the school. So height isn't the important variable. It's actually the design of how the height lands, how the height strengthens or weakens the street. And so you can have this conversation about density done well with design, with emphasizing walking, biking, and transit, not car use. And that's my second component of density done well. And the third component is about the amenities, the service, the social infrastructure that make living in an urban setting livable and lovable, particularly for families. So it's schools and childcare, it's cultural facilities, it's parks and public spaces and playgrounds. It's all of the amenities that make high density living livable and lovable. Because if you're going to have, that's the trade-off. If people are gonna trade living out in the suburbs for living in the city, you have to give them better amenities. And the best urban cities do that. And I amenities include not only things like parks, but just being able to walk downstairs and get fresh food or get your groceries right in your neighborhood a block away. All of those amenities come from high density, high proximate living, if it's designed well. I talk about density done well, not density done right. That's a different word. Density done well, because it's the key to making it successful or not. If you do density well, it makes your life better. It makes your city better. If you do density poorly, and let's be honest, a lot of density is still done poorly, then not only can you make your city worse, you make people hate density. And once they hate density, there's no reason for them to support it, politically or otherwise.
Brent, in terms of amenities, you raised the issue of amenities. As I mentioned in my PowerPoint, we fail miserably in providing amenities. Public spaces, community spaces, you know, for example, playgrounds and things like that, we fail miserably. Now, when land prices are going up, like in Vancouver, for example, I've heard you say that you've had developers pay for making amenities. How do you do that? How can we make amenities when land prices are shooting through the roof, our government doesn't have the money? How can we buy in developers to do that?
Well, I've worked in some of the parts of the world where the cities have the least amount of money, and I've worked in some cities that have the most amount of money. Mm-hmm. And there's always a struggle around amenities and keeping up. But it's a critically important piece. I don't know how you would do it in your context without local government. I think we would have to do a whole masterclass on just the mechanisms of achieving things like amenity, but I'll give you the short answer. In many cities around the world, and I've done studies for cities in many parts of the world, you look at what your regulatory powers are, what you can insist that developers do, but then you also look at your incentive systems. One of the ways of doing it that Vancouver uses very robustly is what's called density bonusing. You have a base level of density, and if developers want to do more, then they have to provide a large portion of that additional value they get from that additional density. It goes back in the form of amenities, whether it's school sites or whether it's parks and daycare, whether it's community facilities or what have you, to make that density good planning, to make that density successful and livable. Because if not, you're just either putting additional pressure on existing amenities that are already stretched, or you're just making people have to travel far distances to get to amenities or live without amenities. What I say is it's your contract. It's your density contract, if you will. If you're asking people and a city to invest and embrace the idea of more dense living, your part of the contract as a government is to deliver those amenities and to come up with financial mechanisms to do it. Often you can leverage, if you don't have the money and you don't have the regulatory tools, then you do it through incentives. If you want more density, you have to build things. That's one of the most common ways to do it. The beauty of it is, if you do it right, it actually lowers land value so that it gets factored into the cost of development. So if any developer says they can't afford to do it, if you've done a good system, then they're not telling the truth. They can. What it means is they can buy land for cheaper because it gets factored into how much they have to pay for land. I say if you do it right, because the worst thing you can do is be inconsistent. If you're all over being inconsistent, then developers can't assume that in the price of land, and you end up getting all sorts of inconsistency problems. So I've helped cities set up whole systems around achieving amenity through mechanisms, financial mechanisms, legal mechanisms, etc. The key is, once you put those mechanisms in place, you're consistent in applying them so that it can start to clarify the value of land for developers who want to have certainty and want to be able to proceed quickly.
Now, one thing that I've noticed has happened in US cities, for example, New York and Washington, DC and other places, is as gentrification of the inner city is taking place, the poor are being displaced. So how do we do inclusionary development? If we have inner city development and amenities come there and all kinds of other things happen, the poor get pushed out. So is there any way to have inclusionary zoning so that the poorer people can be included? This is the dilemma that our prime minister faces now.
You're probably discussing the most challenging element of densification in the context of what I would call financially successful cities. Because anytime in a financially successful city, there's strong market interest to build in new places, you can have a gentrification effect. You can have a gentrification effect even without development. In Vancouver, we've had a principle in place for decades called revitalization without displacement. And it's interesting that both of those words can actually be debated and challenged. First of all, revitalization is always a bit of a touchy word. Revitalization for who? For rich people? Or is it, and how does that affect the existing low-income community? And when you're talking about displacement, the challenge is you can perhaps be successful in not physically displacing people. For example, in our downtown East Side, which is just a few blocks away from me, you had originally, when we were doing the downtown East Side plan, over 10,000 low-income community people who no one wanted to displace. The problem is, even if you're not physically displacing them by tearing down their house and putting them somewhere else, which we don't do in Canada generally, and I say generally because it certainly has happened in the past, even if you don't physically displace them, you can economically displace them. You can replace their low-cost grocery store with an expensive t-shirt shop, is the example I often use, because I actually saw that happen here in Vancouver. So, and you can make it just more uncomfortable for them to live their lives because of different perceptions from other economic classes coming in. So it's a great challenge. It's still a continuous theory on whether or not different socioeconomic classes can interact in more diverse neighborhoods, in more accepted neighborhoods, because there's constantly tensions. I'm not sure I have found, I've had this conversation with chief planners all over the world, and I have not found an easy fix to that. What I usually say is it starts with having that as a key consideration in all your thinking, that you're having those conversations and that the low-income communities are part of the conversation and part of the learning. You're learning from them. And when the decision make is being made, that's a high priority. That doesn't make for a perfect result, but it certainly does make for better decision-making than we've seen in the past with urban renewal and such. Now, you folks have a different kind of challenge around low income and poverty than we do in North America. We don't have shanty towns. Your scenario is more similar to the work I've done in Latin America, where in Medellin and Bogota and Curitiba and others, whole areas of what are called informal settlements become originally created informally and then become institutionalized in a way, made formal as informal settlements by giving them better infrastructure and more stable, structurally stable housing and such. And so I've learned more about that integration of informal settlements into stable communities, supportive communities in my work in Latin America than anything I've done in North America. So I certainly would say we can have a sort of a universal conversation about gentrification, but I think that what I like about what you've talked about is, instead of putting the poor out somewhere else in a shanty town, which seems like a very, I'm not gonna comment on what Pakistan is doing. What I'll say is I've appreciated the cities that have sought to find fair and equitable ways to not displace, either physically or economically or socially or culturally displaced, and integrate into neighborhoods that can be shared neighborhoods. It's not easy, it's a lot harder, so it probably seems attractive to do the lazy approach, but it's fundamentally more fair, fundamentally more right. And the key to it is to have a conversation with everyone at the table.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let me also say, folks, Brent has to leave by 9:30. So if you want to ask any questions, please raise your hands. I'll include you. Meanwhile, I'll continue. Brent, what about master planning? We seem to be, our cities are married to master planning. We make master plans every 5 to 10 years. We don't really follow them, but they kind of become legal binding for us. And we have tons of court cases and all kinds of things happening because the master plan has been locked in. Now, do you guys develop master plans and how do you handle them?
I have to say, I'm confused by the way you've just described it. You said in one sentence that you don't follow them, but they're also locked in and legally binding. Usually the problem with master, so you've literally described both ends of a problem.
That's Pakistan for you. That's Pakistan for you.
You can have master plans that nobody's following, and then what's the point of them? And they're just confusing. But you don't have to worry about them because nobody's following them. Or you can have the kind of master plan where they're locked in and they have zero flexibility. First of all, I have to say the term master plan is used differently in all parts of, in many parts of the world. In many contexts, by master planning, you mean a very, very detailed physical design of a neighborhood and say, this is exactly where the building edge will be and the tree will be and how tall. What I'll say about this, I don't think that there's a right and a wrong answer to master planning versus sort of community visioning versus more flexible, adaptable, iterative planning. I'm not convinced there's a right answer and a wrong answer. I'm convinced there's a kind of an attitude or a tone that is usually either the problem or the solution. And what I mean by that is every planning, all planning, is a combination of creating certainty and flexibility. It's got to be, planning's got to be certain enough so that people who participated in the process and developers who are participating in the economic activity have a sense that what they can do or what they can expect. Everyone wants to know what they can expect. So there has to be a certain amount of certainty. And a master plan that's so wishy-washy that nobody knows what's going to happen, almost everything that happens, people will be mad because they'll say, I didn't expect that. On the other hand, good planning has flexibility for the better idea. For example, look at all the observations we've had about city building during the pandemic. We need to be able to constantly assess our urban setting, not throw away our master plan every 5 years, because then that's pretty useless. I wouldn't bother participating in a master plan if it got thrown away every 5 years. But know what in your master plan is flexible and what in your master plan has to emphasize certainty. What I've actually said, I've worked on and written a lot of master plans, community plans, area plans, and whole citywide plans with varying levels of flexibility and certainty. And what I've always said is the art of a good planning exercise, the art of a good plan, is to know when you should be certain, know when you should build in flexibility, and know the difference. And I've seen a lot of plans that are flexible when they should be certain, and a lot of plans that are certain when they should be flexible. Mm-hmm. So knowing the difference, knowing where you can build in flexibility for the better idea. I always said at my city halls, never let a rule stand in the way of a better idea. The art is knowing a better idea when you hear it. Knowing where you can build in flexibility for the better idea in your planning, whether it's in a master plan or any exercise, and knowing where you need to be certain and clear and predictable is the art of this. Because I'll say this to you, overly rigid master plans are a problem. I'm not a fan of them. They assume we know the answer through everything right now, and we're not going to change our mind, and no conditions will change. That's incredibly arrogant. On the other hand, I think our planning profession has shifted towards these overly flexible visionary statement kind of things that provide no certainty to anybody. And then I've actually been hired by cities after that kind of overly flexible plan has been done. And they said, Brent, we nothing's happening in our city because nobody knows what's allowed. Nobody knows what council's going to approve. Nobody knows how much land is worth because we don't know what's allowed. We don't know how much to pay for land. And so nothing's happening. And when anything does happen, the community's mad because they say, wait a minute, we didn't know we were going to get that. So there's this very dangerous laziness that can, by going too far the other way, by saying we hate master plans, so we want everything to be flexible. The art of it is to know when to be certain and when to be flexible in all of our plan making.
Fascinating. Galaxy A70, who is that? Can you please speak up? I don't know who this is. Hello, can you hear me? Galaxy A70. Okay, if you're not speaking, Zia Bande. Zia Bande, please.
Okay, you can hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Fine,
yes.
Go ahead. Okay, Mr. Brand, it was a lovely presentation. My area of interest is local economic development. I need to ask, you were talking about this urban planning and all these things, a livable city. We all know Vancouver has been there quite long. I just need to understand how you basically incorporate that part of economic development in this urban design to create jobs, to create prosperity. That's one part. Second thing, you have remained as for 6 years as director of planning of Vancouver City. I need to understand that you are a person who is creative, who's professional, who's creating all these design. What difficulties do you face in political maneuvering for approval of these projects? The pressure you get from the council, the pressure you get from the businesses and from the civil society. How you manage all that? These are the two things I want to ask.
Okay. I'll try to give relatively short answers to that, but those are complex questions. On your second question, it's very hard, which is that was the hardest part of the job. First of all, when I was chief planner, I didn't create all the plans. We are blessed in Vancouver with having a very knowledgeable community with very high expectations and standards for how the city should be built and changed. We have a very talented private sector. They don't always agree, the community and the private sector. Sometimes the chief planner and the city staff are referees. But I never like to leave the impression that I'm sitting here at my table drawing out all the plans for everything when I was chief planner. I think the chief planner's role is to set a tone and a vision and to make sure that things that are happening are consistent with the kind of overriding vision for the city to be livable, sustainable, et cetera, and to be a champion for these things. How you orchestrate that in the context of community and developers and politicians, I don't think there was a point in my 6 years where there weren't community people mad at us at City Hall. There were developers mad at us. Developers always thought we took too long. Community members always thought we said yes to too many things. Some said we weren't building it fast enough. I don't think I've ever seen in my 30 years of career actual consensus, which is a word that we planners tend to use a lot, that's our goal, consensus. I've never seen consensus because there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of human beings being involved, all with many different opinions. Our job is to be good listeners. Our job is to learn. Our job is to not be arrogant that we come into every exercise knowing the answer already. And I think the obligation is not that everybody agrees at the end of the day, but that everybody feels like they understand the decision, they understand why, they can put the decision in the context of the larger challenges we have around climate emergency and homelessness and affordability, et cetera, so that it's not just about their specific concern, but it's part of a bigger picture, that we're constantly having this conversation about a bigger picture and the bigger picture goals we're trying to achieve. So it's very, very hard and very challenging. And it's a reason why during my 6 years as chief planner, I didn't get much sleep, because it's just constant. You're constantly trying to educate a conversation and be educated by a conversation on better cities with your community and your industries, et cetera. And it's just not easy. It's just not easy. But it's very important and very exciting, because it's the way we should all be doing city building, I think. A constant challenging conversation, addressing proactively the tensions of what's working or not, talking honestly about what's working or not, and having a very good conversation with your community. One of the things you said in the starting point is that there wasn't much conversation in Pakistan cities or participation with the actual communities in city making, what we call public engagement. And certainly that's a conversation I'd love to have with you in the future, because I think the importance of having a constant civic discourse with your citizens about change in their city, an educated and challenged conversation about it, is critically important to having better outcomes that the citizens can, if not buy into, at least understand, so that that the system is fair. On your question on economic development, I'd like to think that all city building in good cities understands and has integrated economic development. The idea that one of our things we're trying to do is create economic activity, create jobs, etc. So I'd like to think that it's just part of every good city builder's makeup. It's one of many things that is considered. But I know what your question is really about. And I will say this, that Vancouver has struggled with the component of governance that's specifically around economic development. When we hosted the Olympics, for example, in 2010, we actually created a region-wide economic development government structure to help market the region during, before, and after the Olympics. And we wanted that to be a legacy for economic development following the Olympics, because we had done such a bad job. Many of the municipalities in our region here compete with each other instead of seeing each other as partners in competing with other parts of the world. Unfortunately, that new structure only lasted a couple of years, and then it fell apart because, for various reasons, but partially because the cities wanted to go back to competing with each other again. So sadly, I think as a government mechanism, we don't have a good track record in Metro Vancouver of taking a team approach to economic development. But the good news is, I think in all of our city building, there's a lens that says one of the many things we're trying to do here is create economic activity, create economic success, support jobs, etc.
Great. Let me bring in Erba Aslam. Erba Aslam.
Greetings. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. G, we can hear you. Go ahead.
I have just two short questions. Thank you for giving me time. My first question is that can we learn some lessons from behavioral economics? See if we create cities, or even if we create some, you know, a very idealistic society, but the human mind remains the same and there is no behavioral change, how can we achieve this dream of cities? So can we have some lessons from Nadsuri behavioral economics, and which is like the world is talking about? And my second question is a little bit radical, and that is that, you know, we see that people are more happy. The end result of economics is to achieve happiness, quality of life. So there's this school of thought that is like, which says about like, that school of thought is conservative romanticism. And they talk about that, you know, people who were in villages, they were more happy. The quality of life was better there. So why do we need to have these complex cities if our end result is quality of life and happiness? So that okay. is all from my side.
Good, good. Okay, Brent, go ahead.
I heard the second question. The first question, the sound was sort of going in and out on the lady's voice, so I couldn't really fully make it.
Basically, what would behavioral economics or behavioral science say about city making? And the second city is we'd be happier in villages. It's the old Rousseauian thing. So why do we build cities?
Well, I'm a big fan of behavioral science or psychology or just the human dimension of city making. It's almost weird to say that out loud, like it shouldn't be obvious. But how people interact with cities, with streets, with neighborhoods, with each other, and how that can be supported in city making, but not determined necessarily in city making, is fascinating to me. And I'm always amazed that it's not fascinating to more city planners, because it really should be the basis of our work. I consider myself to be educated by behavioral science, city psychology, urban psychology. I read and learn as much of it as I can. But I found I did that after I graduated from school. It certainly wasn't taught to me in any of my planning degrees. So I'm glad you brought it up. I find it very interesting. I think we need to integrate it more into our thinking. On the specific related issue of happiness, which is a great part of the behavioral psychology conversation, I see it as a lens. You know, quality of life, happiness, lovability is a word of you love your city or not. All of these terms have been used for some time in the context of city making. Are our people happy in the context of change and growth? You know, it's a tough conversation to have in change, because psychological studies have shown that people don't like change. Psychological studies have shown that we're actually more afraid of what we're going to lose in the context of change than happy about what we might gain in the context of change. And that's universal. It applies to almost everything. We're always more afraid of losing something than we are excited about gaining something, no matter what the thing is. And so I find those kinds of observations fascinating in the context of when we're going out to communities talking about change. People are inclined to not want things to change, even if they are changing. Right now, whether we like it or not. So I think that's, it's a very important conversation in the context of community engagement. On your specific example of urban living, I think what we've struggled with in Vancouver for a long time is building high quality of life in the context of high density, and not have a lazy conversation that sort of says, everything high density is low quality of life. Everything low density is high quality of life. Well, that's not borne out by the facts. What actually matters is quality of development, quality of design, quality of community building. You can have a low density community that is very socially isolated and with a low quality of life because of poverty and other things. You can have a very high quality of life in the context of high density urban living. What the difference is the quality of the urbanism, the quality of the design, quality of the city building, quality of the social networks, social functions, social systems, and all the things that go into happiness that go well beyond city planning. The other thing, to answer your most basic question, why don't we all live in villages? I think the presentation that started this event sort of puts that into a context. If you're growing as fast as you're growing, and you try to physically, mathematically, if you will, accommodate everyone in villages, you will very quickly, in a low density context, use up all your space. The people don't fit. So it really comes down to how you're trying to accommodate people, how many people you're trying to accommodate, and increasingly accommodate them not only in as high quality a context as you can, but a low carbon footprint, low pollution context as you can. So it's not as simple as people are happier in villages, so let's just build villages. If you've got a large number of people that you want to or need to accommodate in the context of housing, then villages won't get you there. It's physically just won't work. But so that's my answer to that question. I will use it to piggyback on a comment that was made. I think you said at the beginning that the government wants to build 5 million houses because there's a housing shortage. So the other part of the answer I just gave you is, just like I don't think you could accommodate the numbers in villages, I don't think you should try to focus on the numbers at all. It makes me nervous. I've worked in many places in the world where a government official has said, we need more housing because of a housing shortage, so we want this many houses. And it becomes this kind of mathematical exercise that says, if we get 5 million houses, we've succeeded. Check. It makes me very nervous because it treats community building and city building like an accountant's exercise. Like all we're doing is math. And it puts great pressure to just build, whether there's a quality conversation there or not. Every city badly needs a quality conversation, and we should not be focusing on number of houses. We should be focusing on building streets and neighborhoods and communities that, yes, have many people living there. But if you focus on housing numbers, that's what you get, housing numbers. If you focus on building community and neighborhood and streets, then you'll get your housing numbers, but you'll get them in a much more successful and better form. So I say that, I don't know your government officials. I don't know if that's a fair characterization of this 5 million number. But I'll say this, I've worked in many places where I've told governors, ministers of housing, et cetera, please stop talking about numbers and housing and start talking about quality and neighborhoods and communities, because you'll get what you want, but you'll get it in a better, more successful outcome.
Excellent point, excellent. Atif Aslam, you'll have to be quick, guys. Atif Aslam, yeah, quickly.
Thank you very much. Just one question. How you are integrating sustainable development goals, particularly SDG 11, into your mainstream development planning of Vancouver?
I don't think SDG applies to Canada. But go ahead. Go ahead, Brent.
I when he said particularly something, he said something.
Oh, don't worry. That doesn't apply to Canada. Sorry, Brent wouldn't know about that. Brent, don't worry about SDG 11. Okay. Doesn't. Okay. That's only for us.
Yeah. Okay, got it. So it may be equivalent to what we call LEED or passive design or step, we call it step code. Every different places, Europe has different codes. I'll say this, one of the things that has set Vancouver apart, but also many other cities I work in, is that sustainable development has been integrated as a basis, as a bedrock for urbanism better urbanism, better city building for decades. Vancouver was one of the very first cities, if not the first city in North America in the 90s, to issue a report that changed our city making called Clouds of Change. And it directly put climate change as a key driver, if you will, no pun intended, for better city making in Vancouver. So since the 90s, we've been doing that. Vancouver was also, at the beginning of last year, the first North American city to declare a climate emergency, and that started a lot of other North American cities doing the same and developing plans to address the climate emergency with that specific word, emergency. And I like that word because it creates a sense of urgency to the speed and distance of our changes, because just like we've seen in this pandemic, when you're in an emergency, you have to behave differently. I don't know if that mechanism you referred to is about buildings. Vancouver was the first city in North America on my watch as chief planner where we brought in LEED Gold with 6 energy points, which is by far the highest in North America standard for all private sector buildings. We did that just before the Olympics because it made symbolic sense to have a gold standard right before hosting the Olympics. Unfortunately, it's been 10 years since then, and we're still by far, we've actually elevated our standard into higher performance standards around passive design, et cetera, well beyond LEED now. And we are by far have the highest standard of any North American city and higher than many European cities. Only German cities and some other cities have probably as higher standards. So sustainability gets integrated at every level of our thinking. At the building design stage, yes, but it actually starts at the community design stage, at the city design stage. We have all sorts of packages of rules and regulations or policies under something we call eco-density, which is about the ecological densification of the city. We created what was called a Greenest City Action Plan under the last mayor and council to try to benchmark against the best cities in the world in 10 categories of sustainable and green city building. So to say it's been a key driver of all of our city making decisions is an understatement. And yet we're constantly struggling with the sense that we're still not going fast enough, far enough relative to the climate emergency. But I could bore you with a bunch of numbers about how successful we've been. We've been very successful in our sustainability performance standards by North American standards. But what I always say is I'm burdened by the knowledge of the cities I'm working with and for around the world that make Vancouver still look pretty behind. So there's always some other cities that can inspire you to go further and faster, which is what we need to do.
So it's part of your quality discussion. Great. And Maz?
It's more than part. It's kind of the bedrock.
Bedrock, yeah.
Yes, and Maz, hello.
Hear me? And Maz, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
All right. So I just wanted to ask a quick question. Could you briefly, Brent, tell us about some of the positive aspects of Soviet and Chinese urban planning? Because we've seen that they focused on a lot of livability with their microgrids, especially in the Soviet areas.
I don't know. Do you know anything about those, Brent? I don't.
I can't talk about Soviet planning. I've been invited many times to do things in Russia. And I presume that's what you mean when you say Soviet. But I haven't accepted any work in Russia for various reasons. In terms of Chinese work, I think Chinese cities have been a fascinating observation for us. Here in Vancouver, half of our population is of Asian descent. We have very strong ties with China specifically because of our role in the Pacific Rim. And so we had many, many delegations come from China to learn from Vancouver urbanism in the context of, we would do one building, they would sprout 30 buildings in the context of the speed of change in China. I've been fascinated by aspirations around eco-city models in China, et cetera. But I have to say this, I've struggled with an observation that the follow-through on Chinese sustainable city building is not nearly as good as the conversations and rhetoric are. And so generally speaking, I haven't seen a lot of things built that I actually think have been, that I've been particularly impressed with. And it's left me with still an observation that China has more problems than it has solutions. Unfortunately, as we spied after the pandemic, Wuhan was one of the first cities to go back to, after reopening, go back to just overwhelming car dependency and urban pollution. So I think they still have many, many challenges that don't necessarily match the rhetoric of their aspirations. I find their aspirations very inspiring, but their follow through is less inspiring.
Okay, we have now the president of our Town Planners Association. So let's have his question. Khurram sir. Khurram?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Yes, Ben. Vancouver definitely is an amazing city. I have been there, and I would like everyone to go there and see how the planning has been practiced there. My question is, as you have been working in various parts of the world, we cannot compare Western cities with the developing country cities. We have definitely different challenges, the challenges you are facing. So do you experience any city which has effectively addressed the attitude problem, governance problem, in any of the developing country?
I didn't quite get that last part. Have I seen any cities that have positively addressed the attitude problem?
Attitude and the challenges we have been discussing.
In developing countries?
Yeah.
We talked about Medellin. Tell them about Medellin.
Yes. It's interesting. When I first was approached 10 years ago to do work in Medellin, Colombia, it was the first time that I would have worked in Latin America. And since then, I've done work in Santiago and Bogota and a few other smaller Latin American cities. But I was quite intimidated. And my thought was the same thing as you just said, which is that you can't really compare the urban challenges in these cities. And as I was preparing for my first trip to Medellin, though, and having these long conversations with the chief planner of Medellin, asking him what it is he hoped to achieve from my work, my help, the issues that he was raising were very familiar to me. And I found it surprising that although they have many different things that we don't have in North America and vice versa, what I found that they were often conversations and challenges of culture and expectation, challenges of confidence of what you could achieve or not. They were challenges of community conversation because they didn't have a culture of talking about city building with their community and wanted to learn from Vancouver on that. They had a challenge around perception on environmentalism, where some people understood that building higher density cities was actually good for the environment, but others thought it was bad and wanted to spread out in low density car dependent ways. So there was a real fundamental misunderstanding of what environmentalism even meant. They struggled with issues of pedestrianism because even though they had invested in transit, people were still afraid to walk, and they wanted to know how we had built a culture of walking city. They had called me very soon after I left City Hall in Vancouver, so they were actually one of my first clients. Since then, when I get called by clients now, I don't just talk about Vancouver because I've worked for hundreds of cities since. But I remember being struck by the fact that although their city was different, we were having the same conversations. And the key was to just make sure you couldn't, in a very lazy way, just take our solutions and plop them somewhere else. But if you're having the same conversations and you're having same challenges of increased car use, for example, as the city starts to get more and more affluent, one of the things I was struck by is that Medellin had the lowest car use of any Latin American city. Only 14% of the city residents actually used cars, but it was going like this because as the city was starting to become more developed and more affluent, they thought that the answer to affluence was to own a car and drive more. And so they were thinking, how do we avoid the problem of having to suddenly build a lot more roads? I'm telling you all this story is because of course there are differences in every part of the world I've worked in. but I found it surprising and fascinating. Now, the more work I do internationally, the more I realize there's about five conversations that every city in the world is having that are critically important to the success of those cities. You just have to be very careful about not answering those five questions in a very lazy way, like it's the answers are the same everywhere. And by the way, no more true, no more is it, no place is it more different than in the informal settlements and what you would call the shanty towns, because that is something we don't have in North America. We have urban poverty in the city in an integrated way. We don't have that those kinds of things. And when I was working and particularly talking to them about how to serve the informal settlements in the context of walking, biking, and public transit, that was probably the conversations where I was most careful about being arrogant about understanding the answers there and recognizing that those cases were very different than what I had experience with in North America. I think the key is to come in with humility, but also a recognition that you don't have to apologize for the fact that every city in the world can learn from other cities. Even when your cities are different, you can be learning from each other. You can be inspired by each other. And the best thing to do is for locals to be inspired by what they've seen and heard from people like me and figure out local solutions.
Good point. Last question, Mohammed Rizwan.
Hi, Brent. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Go ahead, Rizwan.
Okay. My question is, like cities like Delhi, they have built 300 kilometers of urban rail. Cairo has probably 100 kilometers. But as for our for current financial situation, we can't invest on these type of things. So as a transport engineer, I see the solution is in improving urban planning to optimize the expenditures on transport. But the way things work here, politicians like to call the shots directly. We don't have a proper technical governance structure where we have planning councils and all these things. So what would be the easiest way to put up this thing in front of decision makers, that how we can improve our urban planning in such a way that trip lengths are shorter and you address like most of your trips with sustainable modes like walking, cycling, or like buses only, and to try to avoid huge investments on BRTs or urban rail? This is my question.
I always can chuckle when I get asked, what's the easiest way? Well, there's no easy way to do what you've just described. If there was, every city would be doing it. But you're asking the right, you're asking my favorite questions, because I don't like easy, I like hard, and that's a really hard challenge. What I'll say is this: I always emphasize to cities that they need to understand that they're quite possibly underestimating the importance of city planning land use when they're thinking about mobility and investment. We see it over and over again in cities, and I think you described it in the initial presentation, that if you're trying to build alternatives to the car, rapid bus or other technologies, but what you're building out in the suburbs is low density sprawl, then it never really works, because people just aren't close enough. You don't have enough people close enough to the transit to make it a viable alternative to the car. So you have to get your land use right. In Vancouver, for 20, 30 years, we've been saying the best transportation plan is a great land use plan. If you get your land use right, then your transportation mobility shift away from the car stands a chance of success. If you get your land use wrong, I won't say it's impossible, but it's really, really hard to get people to shift to walking, biking, and transit. Now, here's the problem. So you have to have a conversation about smartening up around land use and use it as the catalyst and facilitator for ridership of transit, walking and biking, etc. Here's the problem. Land use takes a long time to change. It changes gradually. And it's not under all a government's control. They can facilitate land use. They can make sure it doesn't go in the wrong places. Like those 5 million houses that the minister wants to build should be built around transit. They should be built in places that facilitate walking, biking, and transit, and in patterns that aren't car dependent. If you land 5 million houses in a car dependent pattern, you're making your region much worse. If you land 5 million people in a transit supportive, walkable, bikeable pattern, you can make your cities and places much better. It all depends on how you land those 5 million people. So land use, critically important. But what do you do in the meantime? What do you do in the meantime? And I'm not a patient person, because we don't have all the time in the world relative to the climate emergency. So we need to be doing both at the same time. As we're starting to make smarter land use decisions, we need to proactively invest in smart transit infrastructure. We need to look for temporary ways to increase housing populations. Maybe it's in other forms of a more modular housing or more fast to build housing, pop-up urbanism, urban catalyst projects, all sorts of ways to catalyze faster land use change and put people in places that are walkable, bikeable, and transit supportive quicker. And you just have to recognize that you're going to have to front end some of that infrastructure before you necessarily have the population support to make it perfect. But that's what you just have to do, because you have to, it's not either or, you have to do both. You have to work on your walking, biking, and transit infrastructure, and you have to work on your supportive land use both at the same time. And you're recognizing that the infrastructure is probably easier because you can build it faster. The good news is that either, people ask me, what's the chicken and what's the egg? If you know that metaphor, I don't know if that's just an English metaphor. Neither is the chicken and neither is the egg. You're doing both. One can be the catalyst for the other can be the catalyst for the other in different contexts. Just do them both, do them well, and integrate them. So it's one conversation, transportation infrastructure and land use smart decision making, one conversation about sustainable city building. I say that like it should be obvious, but too often in cities, it's two separate, disconnected conversations.
Brent, thank you very much. This has been really good. You've given us more than we expected. It's been wonderful. I think the upshot is we have to be smart about building cities. We have to have a quality conversation. In fact, we have to have a conversation about human life. All aspects of human life come into city making, and the conversation has to move away from cars. Unfortunately, we are stuck 20 years behind you. We're copying you 20, 30 years ago. And I'm trying to, through these webinars, jumpstart the conversation to leapfrog. Hopefully you have helped us leapfrog.
Well, leapfrogging, can I just say, leapfrogging is the key. I work in many places that are copying us 20 years ago. And I say, you have the benefit of being able to see that we have come to our senses, at least many of our cities. The most successful North American cities have stopped doing that. And you have the benefit of that. You can, we often said that Canada is 10 years behind the United States in city building. And we always said that 10-year lag was very helpful. We could see what was working and not working, and you could make decisions based on what was working and not working. Just make sure you don't listen blindly to bad North American consultants who will try to sell you on the wrong path. And look at what's actually been working in North America and not been working. And you've got the benefit of being 20 years. I'd look at that being behind by 20 years as a benefit. You can avoid the mistakes we've made.
That's why we picked on the Canadians, because we've had American advice for the last 70 years and we thought we'd go to Canada now. So we are not regretting it. I think it's been wonderful. Thank you, Brent. And as I said, let COVID be over. We'll get you to Pakistan. Maybe you can help us think through things in Pakistan.
My pleasure. Thank you again. I hope it helps. Thank you.
Thank you to everybody. Thank you. All the best. Bye-bye.